This is The Wealthy Bookheads, where we interview important books that can change our lives. I'll ask the questions, and I'll let the book do the talking using words from its own pages. This is essentially a book interview. Your time is valuable, so let's get started. Today, I'll be interviewing How to Think Like a Roman Emperor, The Stoic Philosophy of Marcus Aurelius by Donald J. Robertson. It currently has an overall rating of 4.7 on Amazon, and 78% of the reviewers call it a 5-star book. Question number one, what's the book about? Answer, the book is designed to help you follow Marcus Aurelius in acquiring Stoic strength of mind and, ultimately, a more profound sense of fulfillment. This book combines Stoicism with cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, which is only natural because CBT was inspired by Stoicism. Question: what's the goal of life for a Stoic? Answer: Stoics argue that humans are first and foremost thinking creatures, capable of exercising reason. Although we may share many instincts with other animals, our ability to think rationally is what makes us human. Reason governs our decisions, and the Stoics call it our ruling faculty. We therefore have a duty to protect our ability to reason and to use it properly. The fundamental goal of life for Stoics, the highest good, is to act consistently in accord with reason and virtue. Marcus Aurelius believed that the goal of his own life was not pleasure, but action. Question: what do the Stoics say about ordinary pleasures? Answer: modern English isn't well equipped to capture the distinctions made in ancient Greek philosophy, especially when it comes to describing emotions and sensations. Stoic joy is profound. We use the word pleasure very broadly to encompass almost any positive feeling. However, the Stoics distinguished between the sort of pleasure we get from external things like food or sex or flattery, and the deeper sense of inner joy that Marcus is talking about. It comes from achieving your fundamental goal in life and experiencing genuine fulfillment. This kind of joy makes ordinary pleasures seem trivial by comparison. People can often confuse pleasure with happiness. Chasing empty, transient pleasures can never lead to true happiness in the long run. What we're all really after and seeking in life is the sense of authentic happiness or fulfillment. This reward could only be obtained by realizing our inner potential and living in accord with our core values, not being led astray by superficial feelings. Psychologists now know that people often engage in habits they consider pleasurable, from social media to crack cocaine, as a way of distracting themselves from or suppressing unpleasant feelings. There's nothing wrong with pleasure unless we begin craving it so much that we neglect our responsibilities in life, or maybe it replaces healthy and fulfilling activities with ones that are not. Question: in the book, you write about Hercules, who had to choose between a life of ease and comfort or a life of hardship and purpose. Can you elaborate on this? Answer: one day, as a young man, Hercules was walking along an unfamiliar path when he came upon a fork in the road, at which he sat down and began to contemplate his future. Unsure which path to take, he found himself suddenly confronted by two mysterious goddesses. The first one appeared as a beautiful and alluring woman dressed in fine clothing. She barged in front of her companion and pleaded very insistently with Hercules to follow her path. It led, she promised, to by and far the easiest and most pleasant way of life, a shortcut to true happiness. She told him that he could live like a king, avoiding hardships and enjoying luxuries beyond most men's wildest dreams, all delivered to him through the labor of others. After listening to her for a while, Hercules was approached by the second goddess, a less boastful and more modest woman who nonetheless shone with a natural beauty. To his surprise, she wore a grave expression. She warned him that her path led in a very different direction. It would be long and difficult, and would require a great deal of hard work. Speaking plainly, she told Hercules that he would suffer. He would be doomed to walk the earth in rags, reviled and persecuted by his enemies. He would be called upon to face mounting adversity with bravery and self-discipline. But then the goddess made one more claim. Overcoming great obstacles through courage and deeds was the only true path to fulfillment in life. As it turned out, Hercules famously chose the heroic path of the second goddess, virtue, and was not seduced by the path of vice. Armed with a wooden club and dressed in the pelt of a lion, symbolic of a more primitive and natural way of life, he wandered from one place to another as if the whole world were his home. The gods forced him to undertake the legendary 12 labors, including slaying the Hydra and ultimately entering Hades, the underworld itself. Hercules finally died in extreme agony, betrayed by a jealous wife who tricked him into wearing a robe soaked in blood contaminated with the Hydra's poison. However, Zeus was so impressed by his mortal son's greatness of soul that he granted him an apotheosis, elevating Hercules to the status of a god in his own right. Not surprisingly, Hercules was the mythical hero most admired by the Stoic philosophers. His labors embodied their belief that it's more rewarding to face hardship voluntarily and cultivate strength of character than to take the easy option of embracing comfortable living and idleness. Question: so is the moral of the story to choose a difficult life? Answer: in the choice of Hercules, there are basically two paths forward. One, the path of vice, or following excessive desires and irrational emotions. Or two, the path of virtue, or exercising self-discipline and following reason and your true values in life. The moral of the story is that a hedonistic life isn't satisfying. We can't flourish as human beings and achieve things we can be proud of until we learn to endure certain feelings of pain and discomfort while also foregoing certain pleasures. For the Stoics, the tale of Hercules symbolizes an epic challenge of deciding who we really want to be in life, the promise of philosophy, and the temptation of giving into pleasure and vice. It may require a Herculean effort to keep to the right path, but from a Stoic perspective, Hercules remained cheerful despite the terrible things he endured. He enjoyed a profound sense of inner satisfaction, knowing that he was fulfilling his destiny and expressing his true nature. His life had something far more satisfying than pleasure. It had purpose. Question: it seems the same choice, a pleasure-seeking, easy life versus a purpose-driven, challenging life, is exemplified in the book between Marcus Aurelius versus his adoptive brother Lucius. Can you elaborate on this story? Answer: you could say Lucius chose pleasure before work, Marcus work before pleasure. Both were trained in Stoic philosophy. However, Marcus increasingly dedicated himself to the study of rhetoric and philosophy, diligently working his way up through ascending roles in public office, while Lucius seems to have done very little except enjoy a life of leisure. The younger Lucius was always at the chariot races, gladiatorial games, or banquets with friends. He organized his whole life around the pursuit of empty pleasures. We should learn, like Marcus, to enjoy things that are good for us and others, not things that are bad for us. Indeed, there's a type of inner gratification that comes from living consistently in accord with our deepest values, which can make ordinary pleasures feel superficial by comparison. Question: so a Stoic life is ultimately a happier way of life? Answer: Stoics would respond with this paradox. The life of someone like Marcus, who exercises moderation, is surely more pleasant and involves far less self-inflicted suffering than the life of someone like Lucius, who lacks self-control and indulges himself far too much. That is, Marcus probably was a much happier man than his hedonistic brother Lucius. True, he didn't experience the highs of all the wild parties like Lucius did, but neither did he suffer the lows, the painful consequences of overindulgence. What he gained instead was the more profound and lasting happiness that the Stoics claimed was the result of living in accord with wisdom and virtue, or at least some glimmer of that ideal state. Marcus Aurelius made it clear that his goal was to achieve the utmost joy in his heart and to maintain a cheerful serenity throughout the whole of his life. Having glimpsed this inner peace, he was convinced that it was possible to live consistently in that state of mind. And so the Stoics weren't killjoys. Marcus wholeheartedly believed he could obtain as much healthy enjoyment from simple things as his brother Lucius did from ravenously indulging his unhealthy desires and vices. Question. You mention inner values a lot in this book, and so it seems to be an important topic for Stoicism. How can I find my own values in life? Answer. The Stoics employed the Socratic method of questioning, which exposes contradictions in beliefs. They believed, above all, that the wise man is consistent in both his thoughts and actions. A useful values clarification technique for students of Stoicism involves making two shortlists in side-by-side columns with the headings desired and admired. 1. The desired column equals the things you most desire for yourself in life. 2. The admired column equals the qualities you find most praiseworthy and admirable in other people. This two-column technique can highlight inconsistencies between the two perspectives. It's enlightening to consider the double standard between the things you desire for yourself and the things you find admirable in others. What would happen if you started to desire more of the traits you admire in other people? Many people find the suggestion that they should abandon certain pleasures almost shocking at first. However, the same people often praise and admire others who exercise endurance and self-control and forgo these same pleasures for the sake of wisdom and virtue. If we want to improve ourselves, we should therefore be guided more by qualities we admire in other people. We should live by our true values and principles more than by avoiding pain and seeking pleasure. Question. How could we best implement Stoicism in practical ways? Answer. When teaching people to employ Stoic practices, I found it helpful to have a simple framework. In the morning, you prepare for the day ahead. Throughout the day, you try to live consistently in accord with your values. And in the evening, you review your progress and prepare to repeat this cycle again the next day. I refer to these Stoic exercises as the morning and evening meditations. As soon as you arise from bed and begin considering each of the day's tasks ahead, visualize a fork in the road representing two paths. Picture as vividly as you can the future with unhealthy passions and then the future with wise actions in accord with reason. Contemplate the following two questions. What would be the consequences today if you acted as a slave to your passions? Or, how would your day differ if you acted more rationally, exhibiting wisdom and virtue? And then, throughout the day, we can practice Stoic mindfulness. For example, Marcus frequently examines his own character and actions, and then he commonly asks himself, in different situations, what use am I now making of my soul? We need to make an effort to awaken our self-awareness throughout the day. At the end of the day, we can review our actions and ask three very simple questions. 1. What did you do badly? In other words, did you allow yourself to be ruled by irrational fears or unhealthy desires? Did you act badly or allow yourself to indulge in irrational thoughts? Did you go along with bad habits? 2. What did you do well? In other words, did you make progress by acting wisely today? Praise yourself and reinforce what you did right so that you'll repeat it. And 3, what could you do differently? In other words, how could you have handled things better today? The first and most important reason for reflection is the joy that Stoics experience by glimpsing their own progress, thereby fulfilling their potential in life. The Stoics' main concern is to avoid becoming hedonistic by placing too much value on physical pleasures, indulging in them, and craving them excessively. We should want to replace unhealthy habits with more intrinsically valuable activities. Over time, we can schedule these more beneficial activities every day. Question. Marcus Aurelius suffered with bodily pain, but he learned to endure it without self-pity. How can we learn to cope better with our own pain and suffering? Answer. Marcus believed that complaining and chattering too much about our problems just makes them worse, and more importantly, it harms our character. He mentions many Stoic strategies for bearing pain and illness by viewing them with studied indifference. For example, 1. Separate your mind from the sensation, which is called cognitive distancing, by reminding yourself that it's not things or sensations that upset us, but our judgments about them. 2. View sensations objectively, instead of describing them with emotional terms. For example, say, there's a feeling of pressure around my forehead, versus, it feels like I'm dying, an elephant might as well be stamping on my head. And 3, let go of your struggle against the sensation and accept it as natural and indifferent. This is called Stoic acceptance. It doesn't mean you shouldn't take practical steps to deal with it, but you must learn to live with the pain without resentment or emotional struggle. We should keep our ruling faculty undisturbed by emotional things, including bodily sensation of pain and pleasure. Marcus says this means drawing a line around the mind, marking its boundaries with bodily sensations on the other side, as if viewed from a distance over there. Question. But let's be real. At some point, physical pain is a bad thing, right? Answer. Well, that's a judgment statement. If we can learn to withhold our judgment that pain is terrible or harmful, then we can strip away its horrific mask, and it no longer appears so monstrous to us. We're just left with the banal observation that our flesh is being stimulated roughly. It's just a sensation. Through our judgment that it's intrinsically bad or unbearable or catastrophic, though, we escalate the mere sensation of bodily pain into the inner turmoil of emotional suffering. Question. How do Stoics use language to maintain their rational thinking? Answer. According to Stoic philosophy, when we assign intrinsic values like good or bad to external events, we're behaving irrationally. When we call something a catastrophe, for instance, we go beyond the bare facts and start distorting events and deceiving ourselves. As an aspiring Stoic, you should begin by deliberately describing events more objectively and in less emotional terms. We usually think of rhetoric as something used to manipulate other people. We tend to forget we're doing it to ourselves as well, not only when we speak, but also when we use language to think. The Stoics were interested in how our words affect ourselves, our own thoughts and feelings, through our choice of language. We too often exaggerate, overgeneralize, omit information, and use strong language and colorful metaphors. For example, she's always such a bitch. That bastard shot me down in flames. The job is complete bullshit. People tend to think that exclamations like these are a natural consequence of strong emotions like anger. But what if they're also causing or perpetuating our emotions? The Stoics made a point of concisely describing events in plain and simple language, cutting through misleading language and value judgments, and stripping away any embellishments or emotive language. They tried to articulate the facts more calmly and soberly. Marcus likewise told himself to speak plainly. Indeed, nothing is so conducive to greatness of mind, he said, as the ability to examine events rationally and view them realistically by stripping them down to their essential characteristics in this way. Stoics aim to view events objectively. Question. Is it best then to accept reality, maybe even surrender to our unwanted conditions, in order to minimize our suffering? Answer. There's an early Stoic metaphor of a dog following a cart. The dog, tethered to a moving cart, can either pull on his leash and be roughly dragged along, or accept his fate and run along smoothly beside the cart. We all face the same choice. One of the earliest Stoic definitions of man's natural goal in life is that it consists in a smoothly flowing life, harmony, free from unnecessary struggle. This concept of radically accepting unpleasant things and feelings has likewise become a central theme in modern cognitive behavioral therapy. Pain becomes more painful when we struggle against it, but the burden is often lightened, paradoxically, if we can accept the sensation and relax into it, or even welcome it. Struggling to suppress, control, or eliminate unpleasant feelings, hard as it is, adds another layer to our misery. It can backfire by making the original problem worse. The Stoics deliberately expose themselves to discomfort, such as intense heat or cold, in order to develop psychological endurance. The paradox of accepting discomfort is that it often leads to less suffering. The Stoics believe that he who knows how to suffer, suffers less. Question. How do Stoics resolve their desire for an achievement or a result while at the same time understanding that the result is not entirely under their control? Answer. One of the most important Stoic techniques is called acting with a reserve clause, a technical term that Marcus mentions at least 5 times in the Meditations. In essence, it means undertaking any action while calmly accepting that the outcome isn't entirely under our control. It could take the form of a caveat such as fate permitting, God willing, or if nothing prevents me. It implies that one is taking action while excluding something. Assumptions regarding the final outcome, particularly any expectation of success. The Stoic-minded archer's true goal, for example, should be to fire his bow skillfully, insofar as doing this is within his power. Paradoxically, he's indifferent to whether or not his arrow actually hits the target. He controls his aim, but not the arrow's flight. So he does the best he can and accepts whatever happens next. Question. What is meant by the Stoic concept of an inner citadel? Answer. Marcus tells himself that true inner peace comes from the nature of our thoughts rather than pleasant natural surroundings. He tells himself that resilience comes from the ability to regain composure wherever he finds himself. This is the inner citadel to which he can retreat. In order to achieve this sense of inner peace, he tells himself frequently to retreat to his own faculty of reason, thereby rising above external events and purifying his mind of attachment to them. He believes that to do this effectively, he must reflect, in particular, on 2 concise but fundamental Stoic principles. 1. Everything that we see is changing. It will soon be gone, and we should bear in mind how many things have already changed over time, like the waters of streams flowing ceaselessly. We may call this reflection the contemplation of impermanence. 2. External things cannot touch the soul, but our disturbances all arise from within. Marcus means that things don't upset us, but our value judgments about them do. However, we can always regain our composure by separating our values from the external events using a strategy of cognitive distancing. The Stoic can live with contentment and joy in his heart, even if men are against him and his physical environment is torturous. Marcus condensed this idea into 6 Greek words, which translate as, "The universe is change, life is opinion." Question. What is cognitive distancing, and can you give examples? Answer. Cognitive distancing is the separation between your current perspective and external reality. It provides a way of understanding one of the most important psychological practices of Stoicism, that of separating our values from external events. Observing our thoughts in a detached way, almost as if they were someone else's thoughts, will help you gain cognitive distance and will weaken the urge to act on them. The Stoics do this, as we've seen, in a number of practical ways. You might apostrophize the thought or emotion, which implies speaking to it as if it's coming from another person. You might say, "You're just a thought, and not at all the thing you claim to represent." The thought itself has no intrinsic value. We are the ones who choose to assign value to things that look appealing. You can remind yourself, it's not the things that make us crave them, but our judgments about them. Gaining cognitive distance is, in a sense, the most important aspect of Stoic anxiety management. This is what Marcus meant when he said life is opinion, that the quality of our life is determined by our value judgments because they shape our emotions. Question. But what if our lives are comfortable, easy, and without troubles? How can a person build Stoic endurance and resilience in a happy, stress-free life? Answer. We can practice this skill of separating mind and body during ordinary forms of physical exercise, for example, such as jogging or yoga. We can learn to tolerate with indifference the harmless sensations of fatigue and discomfort experienced while doing these sorts of activities. The most important thing Marcus observed in individuals who coped well during stress was their ability to withdraw or separate their mind from bodily sensations. Taking cold showers allows us to practice the same technique. If we learn these strategies well enough, we may then be able to call upon them to cope with severe pain or severe physical injury in a crisis, even if we're caught off guard. Everyday tolerance of minor physical discomforts can help us build lasting psychological resilience. You could call this a form of stress inoculation. You learn to build up resistance to bigger problems by voluntarily exposing yourself repeatedly to something similar, albeit in smaller doses or in a milder form. Question. Isn't it true that Stoicism encourages people to be unemotional? Answer. A common misconception today is that Stoics are unemotional. The ancient Stoics themselves consistently denied this, saying that their ideal was not to be like a man of iron or to have a heart of stone. Instead, Stoic philosophy teaches us to accept our initial and involuntary emotional reactions as indifferent, neither good nor bad. What matters, in other words, isn't what we feel, but how we respond to those feelings. It's not the things or sensations that upset us, but our judgments about them. And last but not least, my favorite quotes from the book, what I call wall hangers, are as follows. We have a duty to protect our ability to reason and to use it. Hercules had something far more satisfying than pleasure. He had purpose. We should be guided by the qualities we admire in other people. Ask yourself daily, what use am I now making of my soul? He who knows how to suffer, suffers less. The universe is change. Life is opinion. It's not the things or sensations that upset us, but our judgments about them. And that's it for this book interview with How to Think Like a Roman Emperor, The Stoic Philosophy of Marcus Aurelius by Donald J. Robertson. You've been listening to The Wealthy Bookheads, where we interview important books that can change our lives. You can order this book in the links below or on our website if you'd like to support our cause. It puts a few pennies in our pockets without taking any extra pennies from yours. As always, thank you for your time.